Welcome to another edition of Fire Engineering's Tactical Impact. I'm your co-author, or co-host and co-author, Jim Silvernail, and with me is Jason Hovelman, Chief Jason Hovelman from the Florissant Fire Protection District, St. Louis County, Missouri. It's always a pleasure. How are you today, Jason?
Doing great. It's good to be here.
Outstanding. This is the show that's all about tactics. However, today we're going to do things a little differently. We're going to take one of our articles from Fire Engineering from the January 2024. We're going to start off talking a little bit about building construction. But as always, we're going to get back to the tactics and relate this all to our tactical implementation. But without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Jason to introduce the author and our guest and to get the show on the road.
Thanks, Jim. It's always a pleasure to be on these shows and talk tactics. And with any good tactics, we have to understand the building. And the article in the January 2024 Fire Engineering with us is Chief Christopher Thomas from Yonkers, and I'll let him expand more on his bio. But the article talks a lot about these multifamily buildings and the intricacies and nuances of them and the prolification of how fast they're being built. They're in multiple locations, and he's going to discuss his article and why it's important to us operationally and tactically. And so with that, Chief Thomas, thanks so much for being with us, and why don't you introduce yourself and let people know who you are?
Sure. Thank you for having me. My name's Chris Thomas. I'm with the Yonkers, New York Fire Department. Been there about a little over 23 years. I'm a battalion chief. I work in both battalions we have in the city, East Side and West Side. I basically came to this topic. We are directly north of New York City, and we've experienced a massive influx in new multifamily construction. And I realized that it was something that we weren't particularly familiar with as a department. And I realized that a number of other departments probably weren't familiar with it either. So I thought that this was something that we begin to think about because it marks a significant departure from the type of construction we've had in the past.
Yeah, excellent. For those of you that are looking for the article, it's on Fire Engineering's website. It's also in the January issue. It's called A New Challenge, The Millennium Box. I know there's some history that you included in the article, and what caught my eye was that I had never heard it called the Millennium Box, but as you lay it out in your article, it makes a lot of sense. But why don't you provide a little history like you did in the article and kind of lead us through where this came from?
Sure. The origins of what we're calling the Millennium Box really go back to the late 1990s. The root story underneath it all is that there was a desire to build a senior citizen complex, I believe it was, in Los Angeles, and they kept running into a problem. The cost of building a traditional masonry building was too high to justify based on the returns, and wood frame buildings were not permitted because of the size of the building they would need. So the legend has it that while sitting on the beach one day reading a copy of the building code, as one often does, the person who became the architect for this building suddenly realized that if they built the construction in this way using fire retardant lumber for the exterior, they could qualify it as a code 3. As a class 3, and the numbers would then pencil out. Supposedly, other builders, other agencies then sort of looked around and saw this, and a new style was born. There were a number of names for it initially, and there still are a number of names for it. Many of the original buildings were 5 stories of residential over 1 story of either commercial or parking. But then as the code changed, they became possible to build 5 stories over 2 of parking or 4 stories without parking. And because of these, a whole bunch of names came up. So really, we were looking to come up with one single name that would encapsulate this type of new construction. The single most distinguishing thing about them, I think, for most people is just the size of these buildings. They're generally 100 to 400 units, sometimes more. And they seem to have been most popular either on the fringes of big cities or within commuting distance of big cities. In the case of where we are in the Northeast, this means that many of them are in the smaller jurisdictions in the New York City metropolitan area, but outside of New York City. So many of the fire agencies don't necessarily have the staffing or the familiarity with buildings of this scale.
Yeah, if you look at some of the pictures you've got in the article, they're enormous. Just talk a little bit about the construction challenge that you mentioned, and due to the size, scope, and location, and some of the challenges that the construction presents to us operationally.
Sure. So what made these buildings, what makes these buildings different is that they sort of fit into what you could call a loophole. So they are generally built with either one or two layers of parking and essentially what's a type one fire resistive base. Depending on the needs of the locality, this can be either used as parking, it could be commercial space, or some of it can actually be residential space. And on top of this one or two story base or podium is up to five stories of generally residential construction. Technically, this is considered to be type three construction, ordinary construction, equivalent to masonry, because the structural members are framed out in fire-resistive lumber. But all the interior components, the interior structure, similar to an older, more traditional type three building, are all of regular wood, frequently truss construction. The other thing is simply the scale of these things. Because these are large buildings and they're designed to go in large areas, we have them in the smaller ones are generally about 100 units, but we have ones in my district that run up to 450 units. This is problematic to us because it creates simply a management issue. Most parts of the country and where we are, we're used to smaller apartment buildings, 6-8 family apartment buildings, 2.5 story wood frame houses. And simply the logistical challenges of managing a fire in a 450 unit building become significant. Getting firefighters there and managing people that we're removing from the building. You know, it's not out of the question to be, you know, with a 450 unit building, it's not impossible to have to account for 1,000 occupants. So that's a major challenge for us as well.
I think the important thing that you stated was the loophole. You know, anytime that these engineers find a loophole in the building code, it always poses extra challenges for all of us. Mm-hmm. Could you kind of talk about some of the concerns that we have with these type of structures and what we should be looking out for?
Sure. One of the big concerns is that although fire-treated lumber theoretically is considered equivalent to masonry, it's not. You know, masonry does not burn. Brick does not burn. The fire-resistive lumber is measured on a scale, and basically because it falls under a certain level, it's considered to be equivalent to masonry, but it's not equivalent. It will not propagate fire, so if you try to light it, it will not burn. But that said, if the material around it is burning enough at a certain level, it will be destroyed by fire. It will not support fire on its own, but it will decompose and fail. And this creates a problem because, again, as in a typical masonry building, a lot of the interior structural members, such as the floor joists, roof joists, and things like that, are composed of non-fire treated lumber. So a significant fire in any of those components is going to generate a lot of heat and fire exposure for the exterior structural elements, which can cause a complete failure at some point. One particular area that is of concern is especially during the construction phase. Once construction is completed and the buildings are compartmentalized somewhat, the risk is reduced, although not completely eliminated. But especially during the construction phase, when there's massive amounts of freestanding unprotected lumber, the fire risk and the collapse risk is very high.
You talk a little bit about the construction phase. We've seen the videos and we've seen the news reports, it seems like almost weekly, of large multifamily complexes being destroyed by fire during construction phase. Have you seen challenges with infrastructure, primarily water supply and access, during the construction of these types of buildings? And have you seen any favorable or successful ways to mitigate that?
Yes, we've seen the challenges, and frankly, no, I've not seen a lot of successful ways to mitigate it. Basically, it's I think it becomes a risk reward thing for fire in a building under construction. I mean, I would argue that they are, because of the amount of wood and the amount of non-fire treated wood on scene, they are a significant advanced fire is possibly all but unextinguishable. I think the primary approach to a building like that is going to have to be to ensure that all people are evacuated, account for everybody, construction workers, if the site is occupied at that time. And, the initial focus should be on protecting exposures. Once the building is compartmented, you have a much better chance of extinguishing a fire because you can compartmentalize it. But given the speed of spread and the amount of wood on scene that's exposed, we would be hard pressed to control fires and those things regularly. This is only compounded if we have issues with water supply, as we often do on construction sites. Where I am, a number of the sites are what they call former brownfield sites. They were former industrial sites, so they've been mitigated, and basically everything's been taken right down to the ground. They don't have water mains or anything like that. So on a few of these sites, we're stretching in from a significant distance already. Like I said, we may have to assign significant resources right from the drop to things like brand patrol, because they are surrounded by neighborhoods with large amounts of existing wood frame housing. So I think life safety and containing the incident to the building of origin are probably going to be our two main initial strategies, at least for buildings under construction.
Go ahead, Jim.
One of the items you brought up also were the voids possibly created by this treated lumber from the exterior to the interior. What kind of voids have you been seeing? And, I could see that being a major risk in fires, not only fire spread, but also extinguishment and possibly, as we've always talked about, in like a 2.5 or a 1.5, trapping people behind it and causing a major risk. What do you see in these structures and what kind of concerns are there?
Sure. So on the inside, they're built as though they would be a typical ordinary construction building built nowadays, which is to say they use wooden trusses and items like that. So in a number of these buildings, the voids are sprinkled, but that's not universal. So we do have the possibility of significant spread throughout the building by the voids. One other issue that we're seeing a lot of, at least in the Northeast, is the proliferation of electronic bikes, e-bikes, and things like that. So we've had a few e-bike battery fires, and these are very intense fires. So another thing we're considering is the possibility of a fire overwhelming the ability of the sprinkler to control it. This may allow penetration into the voids more quickly, whereas a smaller fire might have been able to be contained within the original compartment before a lithium-ion battery fire takes off. This may not be the case, and if the fire gets into the voids, then we can have a very advanced fire very quickly. An issue like this is basically not a lithium-ion battery fire per se, but fire getting into the voids is what happened about 10 years ago, right across the river from where we are. They had a significant fire in one of these buildings in Edgewater, New Jersey, that resulted in the complete destruction of an occupied building, several hundred units.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the void spaces as well. The differences between the 13 and the 13R that you briefly touch on, because a firefighter may go, well, or even a politician will go, well, this is going to be sprinklered. But there's a big difference and disparity between a full 13 system and a 13R as it relates to things like void spaces and attics and quite frankly, reliability and what they're intended to do, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, it's a full 13 system is intended for to extinguish the fire. Where I think a 13R, you could probably, I think it would be fair to say that the main thing is providing enough time for egress. So where we are, we're seeing more of the 13s because it's the density is rewarded. Because anytime a developer builds a building, right, they're always looking to make a profit, and the profit is going to be based on the construction and on the land price. So I think in the more urban areas, we're seeing the more dense construction, which generally includes the podium construction and the parking garages or the commercial space. In places where there is demand, but a lower level of demand, I think we're seeing more of the smaller, though not small, buildings that can be built under 13R. So, but even, I mean, one of my concerns is that even using the more stringent standards, it is possible to get a body of fire that will simply overwhelm the ability of the sprinkler to put it out. And that for me is a major concern for us going forward.
Yeah, a couple things. Go ahead.
I was going to say a separate but related concern is that a lot of these buildings are being built, again, on the fringes of metropolitan areas. And where we are, at least, it's our county, Westchester County, is a network of very, for the most part, small to medium-sized fire agencies that are divided up into rather small districts. So one thing we're looking at is the need to coordinate among multiple districts, which is kind of a new thing for us. Traditionally, we've had smaller buildings. We've been able to fight our own fires for the most part within our own agency. But with buildings like this, especially with our smaller jurisdictions around us, we're looking at the need for massive coordination among multiple departments. And that's something that's going to have to be addressed going forward as well.
Yeah, you know, just looking at that requirement, you know, when you look at NFPA, you know, when they state a high rise, even though it's not considered, it may or may not be a high rise considering on how tall it is, their requirement is 42 personnel at one of these structure fires. I can tell you that our county SOG, because of our staffing, almost requires a third alarm just to fulfill that 42 members on a call. So, I mean, massive considerations on the scale of these things, I would imagine.
Absolutely. In Yonkers, we're fortunate. We're a decent sized city, about 210,000 people. So we do have 18 companies on duty at all times. But even that, I mean, we're very quickly going to use up the vast majority of our resources, and mutual aid just to protect the rest of the city is not out of the question. And we are far and away the largest agency in Westchester County. I don't know of another agency off the top of my head that could probably put those numbers on the ground with their on-person staffing, on-duty staffing. So for the smaller departments, and especially the volunteer departments in Westchester, it may require banding together 5, 6, 7, 8 fire departments to get those numbers on scene very quickly. And I don't think that anything in the code has really accounted for the need for this coordination. So that's something we're going to have to look at going forward. Even for a career department such as Yonkers, I believe that multiple alarms very quickly are going to be critical just for personnel accountability. Where are we going to put 800 people at 3 a.m. in the middle of February during a snowstorm? You know, simply accounting for the people who's present, who's missing, and finding a place for them is going to be a tactic or a task that's going to require a significant number of people.
You mentioned earlier about builders and contractors are trying to squeeze as much profit and revenue out of these, and the density, right? They want as many units on a footprint as they can get. And 13R does allow them some of those trade-offs, things like interior corridor length, not water supply requirements, things like that impact us operationally. Has there been any changes to adjust that? Because a lot of our hose packages are based on a certain length that we're used to, like you mentioned, the older buildings, and having the forethought to say, hey, well, these bigger buildings, number one, are they being built below the minimum threshold for standpipes, corridor links, you know, access, things of that nature.
So yeah, there are a number of changes for us. Where I am in particular, we do have a modest number of high rises, mostly in the sort of a mid-rise range, the 7 to 15 stories. So we do have some familiarity with standpipe operations and that sort of those sort of tasks. But buildings like these are going to require a much greater familiarity with standpipe operations, simply because although the heights aren't that extreme, the lengths of the stretches are going to be extremely long. So we are studying that. We're actually looking at reevaluating our standpipe kit. We currently use 1¾-inch hose with smoothbore nozzles. We're studying the possibilities of switching to 2-inch hose with a 1-inch tip to increase flow and reduce friction loss. But the strategies that we've traditionally used for our smaller buildings, hooking up on the floor below, for instance, for a measure of safety, may not be possible in some of these buildings given the lengths of the stretches. So we're going to have to become more proficient with stretching from the fire floor through fire doors to attack fires and really using standpipe stretches of all kinds. And this also means that for our engine operators, we have to greater familiarity with pumping into these systems using fire pumps. In general, it requires a greater level of sophistication all around, because most of our buildings traditionally have been, as I said, small 2.5-story wood frames and even small tenements, but generally the sort of buildings that you could attack the vast majority of the fires with pre-connects. And we're switching to a model where pre-connects are simply not going to work anymore.
I was going to ask you that question, how your high-rise kits were set up, but you answered it. How many companies do you feel are adequate, or what is your SOG on getting just one line in place in a building with a long stretch like this off a standpipe?
So that's a great question, because that's actually something else we've been revising. And we have just recently, over the last year or so, made it a point to really adjust the language in our standpipe. One of the things we've run into is just that we realize there's a need to reemphasize we have to get the first line in operation. That is key. Traditionally, especially with the smaller buildings, you know, there's been a kind of a culture where first company will stretch a line and the second company will stretch a backup line. And, you know, we wind up with too many companies stretching too many lines, and the focus is not on getting the first line in operation. So we've changed our SOGs to literally state, you know, the job of the first due engine is to get a line in place and in operation. The primary job of the second due engine is to make sure that the first due engine's line is in place and operating successfully. And we've also gone from a training perspective to go around to the company saying, listen, we have to get that first line in operation, whatever it takes. If it takes 6 companies to get the first line in operation, obviously that's a problem. There's something seriously wrong going on, but we have to get that first line in operation. There is no point in stretching an unsuccessful second line after an unsuccessful first line. If we have standpipe issues, we have to do whatever it takes to overcome those issues. If that means stretching a 2.5 or a 3.5-inch hose with a Y gate all the way up the stairwell from an engine, then that's what it means. If it means stretching into the base of the riser to feed the riser, then so be it. But no one should be stretching a second line until we have a first line in operation. And getting that message out there and implementing that is definitely a cultural point that we've really been working on with our firefighters in the last year.
That is a phenomenal point. And we have that problem almost daily where we operate in a suburban environment, in, you know, lower staffing, and especially in areas where you don't have true truck companies. You know, everything's got a pump, everything's got a water, so everybody feels the need to, hey, I'm going to pull a line off because that's what I do. When really, no, what we do is put water on the fire with the main line. That's who puts a fire out. So we've actually had to do the same thing where we culturally had to step back, push back the backup line. Now, they are essential. Backup lines are 100% essential.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
But priority-wise, it's always on that first line. I think you bring up a great point in the fact that we have to put the emphasis on getting that front line in place. In some cases, even in certain areas, a residential structure fire, that might take three companies because – and what I'm saying is, you know, pulling the line, supporting the line with the water supply – and also doing the truck company operations that support that line, that's getting three or even sometimes four deep, depending on your staffing and your operation. But I think that's so essential. And this is a valid point.
Absolutely. I mean, definitionally, a backup line has to be a second line. So we can't have a backup line until we have a primary line. And again, we've, you know, just getting that in place, if recognizing that there's issues and communicating that there's issues and having the second do, the third do, the fourth do engines, realizing that those issues are occurring and getting going on solving those issues is key. And it's really is something that we've been training on heavily.
To that point, I'm looking at some of the pictures in your article and how they've situated some of these buildings. Mm-hmm. Really prevents you from a rescue standpoint access from multiple sides, which just reemphasizes the need to get that first line in place as quickly as possible, get it to the right place with the right, you know, all those things. So, you know, the way that these are situated, it even makes that more paramount.
Absolutely. So with us, we're on the Hudson River directly north of New York City, and the rail line runs pretty much along the river. And that's where the traditional downtown is, and that's where most of these buildings have been going. And a very good number of them are actually directly up against the Hudson River, which is it's a major body of water. It's probably a mile wide by where we are. So it's nothing that you're getting across. To put it that way. So being up against the river does give us seriously limited access to parts of the building. Another thing is the way these buildings are constructed, especially the taller ones, they are built on this concrete podium, as we discussed earlier, whether it's a parking garage, commercial space, or whatever. And then the wood frame portion of the building is constructed on top, almost as a separate structure. Obviously, when you build a garage, a utility space, a commercial space, you don't need windows as much. So the base structure is generally a square because that's what's going to maximize the amount of parking that you can create and all that other stuff. When you get to the residential component, there's a need for windows, balconies, and things like that. So the residential part of the building up on top is not in the same shape. It's not in the square shape. It's usually more of an H or an E shape, something along those lines. What this means to us is that there are large courtyards up on top of the parking deck that are inaccessible by aerials. And due to their height, they're inaccessible by ground ladders. So we have very, very limited ability to access significant parts of the building. We have actually been responding to this and by training on roof rope rescues. New York City, directly to our south, has seen a significant increase in the number of roof rope rescues lately due to rapidly intensifying fires due to lithium ion batteries. But we're also in a scenario where we may have people at windows, especially if there is a lithium ion battery preventing escape, where that may be our only method of accessing these people because we're not going to be able to get our aerials in there. We're not going to be able to get our tower ladders in there. And they'll be both beyond the reach of ground ladders and also not in a position where we can easily get ground ladders up there to even set up in the first place. So that's a consideration and a tactic that we're reviewing because we feel that that may become increasingly necessary with the design of these buildings.
That's an interesting point. Go ahead, Jim. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, I think another point that I keyed in on was the fact that you said, you know, we get lulled in the fact that we think it's sprinkled, that everything is taken care of, you know. But you bring up a very good point with these lithium ion batteries. We can overcome that sprinkler. Your sprinklers are designed to hold fire in check until we get there, reinforcing once again the importance of our water streams getting there in a quick and rapid manner. I think that, you know, just that fact alone just completely puts an extra challenge But my question to you was, in the construction of this, in the interior wood members, are you seeing a lot of engineered wood still, or is it the real lumber?
Honestly, it's whatever is cheapest at that point in time. It could be engineered. It could be truss. We do see metal studs used as well, if that's what is available and priced right that day. It's really a complete mixture. The key thing, though, is the truss framing, and I mean the engineered wood and all these things. They're much more susceptible to quicker failure, quicker burn through because they lack the mass, and also just decomposition when they have significant components, significant amounts of glue and OSB in them and things like that. So that's our main concern, is that these things will just fail. But realistically, what we have inside, I mean, we inspect them, but I don't think that we can really generalize that this is how they're built. It's really whatever's available that day.
I would think that's important because of the void spaces as well. I don't know your code that well up there, but I would imagine engineers do whatever they can not to put those sprinklers into the void spaces, therefore making a massive problem, a massive challenge for fire, spread and extension. Like I said, you just can't take the sprinklers for granted.
Right. And it seems that a lot of them are run with PVC. So another possibility is sprinkler failure, that we don't always necessarily address. And again, the issue with sprinkler failure, because we've had sprinkler failures in a number of these buildings unrelated to fire, just simply lines that have cracked and failed. And even that, we had an issue where a sprinkler riser cracked and wound up flooding about 80 apartments in one particular building. So just even that, I mean, even the scale of managing the issue, 80 apartments, that's a lot of people to be displaced. That's a lot of water to be moved. And it's a very large main to stop. So a simple issue like that, you're shutting down sprinkler protection entirely to a large part of the building. And once you lose that, by being part of such a large system, what if the fire is extending to other parts of the building? So we don't know, we can't necessarily depend on this sprinkler protection to be intact all throughout the entire building. One fire can cause a failure of the sprinkler system. And once the sprinkler system fails, the rest of the building or a significant portion of the building can be very easily unprotected.
You mentioned the roof rescue, and I was curious as to what types of roofs are you seeing primarily on these? Are you seeing flat roofs, peak roofs, that from a rescue perspective and from, if needed, a ventilation perspective, and the associated challenges with those?
So we're seeing almost universally flat roofs. They're simpler to construct, and there's a lot of equipment up there, which is also a significant change. So I don't think that we've had a whole lot of solar up there as well, just the equipment load in general. We're also seeing limited ability to access these roofs, which has been kind of problematic within the building. And also just because the buildings are set back from the street a bit. So sometimes that makes it difficult to reach them by aerial from the street. As far as ventilating them, we haven't had a major fire in one yet, so I really can't say with any certainty, but we haven't experienced any particular problems with that. But given the size of these buildings, flat roofs seem to be the preferred choice, although occasionally we will see some sort of decorative parapet or something like that along the front.
And also taking into consideration the layout, like you just mentioned, that exterior stream application looks like it's very difficult. So again, just kind of reemphasizing the need to understand the building and getting that first line in place, because you may not have the opportunity to stop it from the exterior until it takes over, the entire floor building.
Yeah, absolutely. If we have a fire in one of the apartments facing the courtyard, we are going to have a very difficult time operating master streams. We do carry a Blitzfire device, which is a portable deluge nozzle. But clearly setting something like that up is not going to be quick or easy, especially if we have to get up two floors on top of a parking garage to set up the device and to feed it. So really the interior attack, especially if it's in a courtyard apartment, is going to be the way to go. And it's going to be key to get that line into place. And we're going to have to potentially do some rather long stretches. You know, we have to get used to long stretches down hallways when hooking up on the fire floor, which, again, is something that we've traditionally tried to avoid doing just to provide a measure of safety. But these buildings really give us no choice. To try and stretch from the nearest stairwell as opposed to the nearest location in a hallway for the riser, we could be looking at an 8-length, you know, 5, 6, 7-length stretch, and that's just not feasible. You know, no company carries that much hose, and we would have friction loss issues as well. So that's kind of a shift in our whole fire attack plan.
In regard to that long stretch and getting a little bit off the water aspect, but going into truck company operations, what's the ventilation profile like in those buildings? Is it any different than any other high rise, or because of the long stretches, it makes it more challenging? And especially when you said that the roof access was a challenge.
It is difficult. In our particular case, it's also difficult because we tend to have the wind tends to come in off the water, and we get decent winds in that particular area of the city. But the windows are also not designed to be open for the most part. So that means that we have to either remove the window or operate with minimal ventilation, at least at first. The fact that, again, many of the apartments face a courtyard or they don't face the street means that we are largely precluded from taking the windows from the outside and coordinating ventilation with suppression. So that's a potential issue. And the length of the hallways means that getting a truck company in there is a little more it takes a little more time to get a truck company down there, just because there's more coordination and there's more territory to be traversed inside. If we can get to the roof, there's certainly always a possibility of ventilation from the roof from the outside. But depending on the floor, that can be a rather tricky proposition. For a top floor fire, it's probably doable. Maybe, but for a lower floor fire in an apartment facing a courtyard, that can be very difficult to basically impossible. So I think one of the things we're going to have to deal with too is also the increasing number of people that we're going to be dealing with. The long hallways mean more apartments, mean more occupants. So we found occupant removal and management to be a significant task in and of itself. So for that reason, for fires in buildings of this type, we're looking at going to a second or third alarm virtually immediately, just to manage the people coming out and to make sure that the hallways are clear and that we don't have people down in the hallway. A fire where the apartment door fails to close, which we've had, and there's been a number of high profile incidents recently that charges the public hallway with smoke, mean that we could potentially have a significant number of people down in the hallway. And the fact that these are not type 1 buildings, they're not fire resistive, means that generally in a wing of the building with significant fire, we are going to want to make it a point to evacuate everybody. So again, this just sort of multiplies the challenges and requires significant additional manpower to mitigate even small incidents.
Yeah, I mean, we take it for granted. You know, the book says, you know, designate one stairwell for attack, one stairwell for evacuation. But if those aren't close together, that's kind of a challenge. And that's, can't take it for granted, especially in those tight hallways.
Absolutely. And, you know, we know these things, but many people, even people that live in a building, don't always necessarily know exactly where the stairwell is. So you have people that get disoriented. Excuse me. Most of these stairwells are, are used for emergency access only. They're not the routine access or egress from the building for most people. So they're not always necessarily familiar with exactly where the closest stairwell is, where the second closest stairwell is. So that confusion is going to be our enemy, because it's going to require firefighters to simply direct people and to assist in the removal. And again, that gets us very quickly into second alarms, third alarms, fourth alarms. And, you know, then we have the issue with coordinating these incoming companies. Are they, you know, do we have the chief level staff to coordinate these responses? Do we have the, do our company officers have the training to manage, you know, safety officer functions and things like that, and just accountability functions, which are not stuff that we've traditionally focused on, because again, most of our buildings have been small enough that it was relatively easy to account for the number of occupants.
Because talking about the corridors and the self-closing doors not always operating, and the number of people that are potential victims in these incidences, and the length and size and scope, just how important is it to protect those interior exposures beyond the suppression side? I know we want to get the first line in place as soon as possible, but if we're talking about evacuation, we do have to protect those interior exposures.
Interior exposures are enormous. And I mean, definitely stretching the first line is a part of that. And also making sure that the hallway is clear. But to the extent we can contain that fire, it's night and day. We are just, we're just a few miles from the Bronx here. We had that fire where tragically 17 people passed away in a high rise about a year and a half ago. And I mean, the main body of that fire was contained to one apartment. The people that died almost universally died of smoke inhalation or products of combustion. So I mean, that's probably our bigger enemy than fire in a lot of these buildings. I mean, we have a decent shot at containing the fire to the apartment of origin, assuming again the building is completed and ready for occupancy. But managing that and managing the people coming out of the apartments is going to be big. And a large part of that is going to be self-closing doors and in both the stairwell, and also in the apartment. We had a fire in a high-rise building about, a year and a half, 2 years ago on the third floor, where we had that issue. The apartment door had been disabled so that it was no longer self-closing, and resulted in the fire spreading from the apartment, incinerating the third floor hallway. Miraculously, no one was killed, but it was a minor miracle that we did as well as we did. But the smoke, this was a 27-story building. The smoke ran all the way up to the top floor in the stairwell. So really, there's a major role for code enforcement in these buildings, because these buildings, even more so than a single family house or a small apartment building, are heavily dependent on devices mandated by the code to maintain their safety. Standpipes are key. The proper flow is key. The self-closing doors are key. Without this, we have the potential for a real catastrophe, much more so than in the traditional smaller buildings, I think.
Well, it's not uncommon for these types of buildings and occupancies to see exterior fires that auto expose, or because the units are small enough that the fire does break out and auto exposes to the upper floors. And you've already mentioned the difficulty of getting to all of those sides. What type of materials are you seeing being installed on the sides of these buildings, and what type of contingency plans do you have for those particular instances?
The buildings vary. They tend to look the same. I believe most of them are, the materials for the siding themselves are not combustible, but we do have a number of buildings that are fairly close together. Another issue probably inadvertently arising is the shift to exterior natural gas meters. Most of these apartments and the buildings are metered individually. So we have massive banks of gas meters along the sides of these buildings, including between the buildings where they're, you know, relatively close, probably 20, 30 feet apart. So there is always a potential for a significant gas-involved fire on the exterior. And while, again, as a fire-resistant exterior, it doesn't want to burn, at a certain point when you have enough fire, if it can work its way inside, as the material decomposes by exposure to fire, you have the possibility of a fire getting from the outside to the inside. And since the meters are on the outside, they're vulnerable to, you know, tampering or accidents of various sorts. So fire getting from the outside into the inside is not a, I wouldn't say it's a primary concern in a finished structure, but there is always the possibility of random events, whether it's a car fire next to the building, car fire near the gas meters, an accident of some sort. So it is something that we do have to worry about. Again, the material itself won't burn, but if exposed to fire, it will decompose. And if the fire gets into the interior of the building, then we have combustible interior structural components. And we would have probably less of an issue with that if the exterior was true masonry.
All right. We're coming up on that 45-minute mark, Chief. Before we close this out, is there anything that you want to share that we didn't cover? Anything you want to reemphasize and tell the people that are listening and watching?
Sure, just a couple of things. The first thing is the emphasis on getting that first line in place. There's an old saying that I was always told, as goes the first line, so goes the fire. I think that's increasingly true with this. And really, even more so than in the past, fires in buildings like this, given the scale, are really going to re-emphasize the need for teamwork. That everybody stretches their own line, you know, culture, the aggressive trying to be the first company in culture is simply not going to work in these buildings. This is not the place for freelancing. This is going to require a much higher level of organization from the top down, and that includes the chiefs as well. We are really going to need to take greater steps to coordinate these fires in these buildings and manage fires in these buildings. There's too much of a possibility of firefighters getting lost, getting injured, just given the scale of the building. That much more room to operate is that much more room to run and is that much more room to search. This includes, like I said, getting the first line in place using multiple companies, getting the backup line in place using multiple companies, coordination of truck activities, considering the staging of FAST or RIT teams within the building possibly, as opposed to at the front of the building at a command post like we're probably typically more used to, and just general awareness of the issues. Getting above the fire, checking voids early is going to be critical in buildings like this, and being aware of these, how they're constructed and where the voids potentially are. Any indication of a fire in a void or any condition of something such as a lithium ion battery that may overwhelm the sprinkler is going to be key. Understanding and managing standpipe system operations, fire department connections and all that, how they work, where they fail, how they can fail, how you know if they're failing is going to be another issue. And just preparing for both intercompany operations and interagency operations for the smaller jurisdictions, which are most of us, even up to medium-sized cities. There's going to be a greater need for mutual aid operations, a greater need to have relationships with other jurisdictions. And these things really have to be laid out ahead of time. At 3 a.m. outside the on the exterior of a massive apartment fire is not the place to meet a chief from a neighboring jurisdiction for the first time. Where we are in the Northeast, we have a lot of traditionalists. There's still a lot of 10 codes, probably getting away from 10 codes and things like that for any agencies that still do that. Where in my area, we have three different jurisdictions that all abut each other, have three different codes for a working structure fire. So making sure that we're talking about the same thing when we're talking to each other is key. And just developing the use of staging areas, things like that. All these larger scale tactics that we've traditionally not done a great deal of in smaller and medium-sized departments, I really believe are going to be key going forward. And again, all the groundwork for this stuff has to be laid ahead of time. We are not going to be able to do it successfully at a fire. And again, the idea of assigning personnel whether fire personnel or recognizing the need to manage the number of people that we're moving from these buildings, potentially hundreds of people that may need to be relocated on short notice, just having a plan for this. So jurisdictions are going to have to do all this. Figuring out a way to do it is going to be key going forward, I believe.
Chief Thomas, I just want to thank you for being here today. Obviously, the theme of our show is tactics, and you brought us a great challenge that really made us think tactically, bringing new challenges that just aren't your bread and butter, and I hate that word, bread and butter residential structure fire. But my big takeaway today was, you have to treat these like high-rise fires, even the low-rises. I've heard so many chiefs that say, well, we don't have high-rises here because it doesn't meet the NFPA 75-foot, requirements. Well, you don't need that to have to understand the tactical implementation that we're talking about today. These are the same tactics that have to go and, be used for high-rise fires, using standpipes, the same ventilation tactics like we talked about, the search and rescue. All these aspects are still high-rise operations. And like you said, you have to be ready for those. You have to have the resources available. And in my opinion, like in our area, if we get something in a building like this, it's an automatic third alarm just because. And I really liked what you said about we're still evaluating what's going to work for our organization. So many of us don't do that. They take the cookie cutter. This is high-rise. Well, that depends. Is that cookie cutter from an agency that has 5-person engine companies? If you don't, then you're going to have to figure out a way to make it work for your organization. Even that organization that uses 5 on an engine company still uses 2 engine companies to get that first line in place. Therefore, it might take us 3, with the staffing that we have. But I really like what you said about reevaluating, and I think that's key in getting the first water on the fire.
Yeah, I've heard these buildings of this type likened to horizontal high rises, in that sense that they implicate a lot of the issues that you're going to see in a high rise, except that there's one significant challenge, and that's that they don't have the fire protection that you have in a high rise. So at least in a high rise, your structure is should be fire resistive or non-combustible, and you don't have that here. So that just imposes another challenge. But other than that, I mean, all the other stuff, absolutely. And the fact that because they're not going up, but rather they're going horizontally, as I said, they're being built in smaller communities, particularly on the periphery of larger cities. Pretty much any place we're seeing them come up where there's mass transit connections. So many of the departments don't have the staffing that you would get in the core of a major city, where they would be more used to this sort of fire and just frankly have the density of fire companies to provide a quick response for this. So that's a whole nother challenge to it. But yes, in a lot of ways, they are very much like a horizontal high rise, I think.
Excellent, Chief. Thank you enough for coming on and having this great discussion. If anybody would have questions for you or want to get in contact with you, what would be the best way for them to reach out to you if they needed to?
Sure. I have a fire department email. It's Christopher, Christopher.Thomas, Thomas, at YonkersNY.gov. That's my department email. It's probably the easiest way to get a hold of me, and I would be more than happy to do anything I can for anybody that's interested in this topic.
All right. Thank you, Chief.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And before we go, we always mention you can always find articles like this and many more in our magazine, Fire Engineering. This was in January 2024. Catch this and many more, like I said, and we hope to see a lot of you at FDIC coming up. And before, I would be remiss if I did not announce, and it's already been announced, but to once again reiterate the fact that my co-presenter here will be doing the keynote of FDIC on Thursday morning. So please be there. It's going to be phenomenal. He's got a great message, and I'm looking forward to it. So Jason, congratulations, pal. And I know we're all looking forward to it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, if that's it, I think we're going to conclude another great episode. I appreciate you all for tuning in. Tune in again for another episode of Fire Engineering's Tactical Impact.